Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're okay. I hope you're having an okay week in the continuing madness. It's so hard, isn't it? It's so hard. So I just hope today is one of the easier days, because I find some days a little bit easier. So I hope that today when you're listening, it's one of the slightly easier ones. Thank you so much for your amazing comments and Insta messages and tweets and emails about the series so far. It is so appreciated. If you have been enjoying it, please do rate, review and subscribe. I know we all ask you to do that. It's really annoying, but it really does help make the show available to more people. So if you've done that already, thank you so much. So Griefsters, for those of you in the DMC, I know that this week might be a bit shit, to put it lightly. It is, of course, Mother's Day on Sunday. I'll be 100% thinking of you on Sunday. I know what Father's Day. Some years is fine for me. Some years is awful. My only advice is to stay off social media. Sometimes I think that's easier because then you just don't trip over anything you're not expecting. But, you know, whatever works for you. Because it's Mother's Day on Sunday, we wanted to do an episode acknowledging that. So this week I'm speaking to an incredible woman. Her name is Janelle Aldred. Janelle was a former newsreader and journalist for BBC, ITN, ITV, and she's now a communications consultant. She's currently writing her first book about communications and social justice. And yeah, she's an incredible woman, absolutely incredible. I was so grateful that she came to speak to me. Now, Janelle is also an ambassador for SANS. SANS is the Stillbirth and Neonatal Death Charity. They're an amazing charity. They support anyone affected by the death of a baby. They work in partnership with healthcare professionals. They also help with the family, and they are trying to promote improvements in practice and fund research. So Janelle has been become an ambassador for them and doing work for them. If you want more information about SANS, please do head to sans.org.uk, where you can find where you can donate or find information about the work that they do. Janelle came in to talk to me about her baby daughter, Sade.
So SANS is the Stillbirth and Neonatal Death Society, and they're a charity who support and advocate not just women who've lost babies. They actually deal with whole families and partners and extended family and friends, and really support everyone on that journey of loss and bereavement. And so they were a charity that I used when I lost my daughter, and so I am really proud to be an ambassador for them and to work on advocacy. And something that they are really working on as well is looking at why so many babies still die every day in the UK. And that's a big part of their work, as well as supporting people, is actually how do we prevent this from happening. So that's a bit of the work that they do.
So they're, yeah, amazing charity, SANS, absolutely amazing. So you've said already, and we always start the show by saying who are you remembering today? So I assume it is your baby daughter.
Yes.
So would you mind telling us just a little bit what happened?
So my baby daughter, Sade Rose Maria.
What a name, that's beautiful.
A beautiful name, and Maria's kind of a name that runs through the family. My mom and my sister both have that as a middle name. And I was 19, I was scared to find out I was pregnant at 19, firstly. That was not something I was trying to do. And then went to 40 weeks and 10 days of pregnancy, had the baby shower.
Wow, so you were really...
I was full term. Had the baby shower, had the pram, the room was decorated, the cot was up, the clothes were washed, ready for the first wear. So I was, you know, all the way advanced in my pregnancy.
And also over your pregnancy, right? Like once you've 40 plus, so you know, you were... at the point where people are like staring you in the street, right, being like, oh my gosh, like you're gonna pop.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully, you know, you think you're at the stage where midwives would recognize, you know, I should be popping. And I saw 7 midwives in 1 week, and despite my pleas and kind of my requests that, you know, I wasn't feeling good and I didn't feel okay after having a fairly, you know, fine pregnancy. Yeah, Sade Rose died at 40 weeks and 10 days. And, you know, the fallout of that, I think, has been something that's taken a long time for me to come to terms with. One of the reasons being that I was just 19 when it happened, just like really young and not really understanding the full magnitude of what you've been through and what you've lost as you try to keep living life. Because I was still young and I'm quite ambitious and determined.
So you're only 19 and you find out you're pregnant, and obviously as you said, you go I'm sure you went through roller coaster of like, oh my god, okay, amazing. And your pregnancy up until that point was like normal, everything's fine, no one was watching you or like concerned about anything.
No, and at, you know, at 19 your body is fairly supple and kind of
it's right time to do it, isn't it? Yeah.
Supple for it, yeah. And so in that sense, you know, the pregnancy was just A-okay. You know, you have your couple of twinges when you're pregnant, things that you're nervous about, first time your body's going through it, so you know, it's like, oh, what's this growing pain? What's that ache? You know, but beyond that, nothing at all concerning in my pregnancy.
And what you said that week when you saw 7 midwives. So what was the, I mean, obviously, I always get this wrong. I think 39 weeks is like average, isn't it? And then once you start, or maybe it's 40 in this country.
It's about 40 weeks. 40,
isn't it? Yeah, sorry. It's 41 in France, isn't it? And it's like 39 in America. So it's always a bit fuzzy. But about 40 weeks, they start hassling you. So yes. I've had 2 children and I went over the first time as well, and they start hassling, they start being like, oh, you know, it's 40 weeks, what are you going to do? And you, the sort of traditional things, you have to sort of fight a bit of like, leave me alone. So what happened that that week with the midwives? Were they just kind of checking up on you and everyone just, what was their reaction? Was it just like, yeah,
no,
come back?
I was calling them, like,
oh,
I was
really?
I was calling them and I was saying, you know, I don't feel great, I don't feel very good, you know, my mom insisted they kept me in hospital one night, they sent me home the next day, because I was in slow labour for that whole week.
Wow.
And so this was back in 2002, and,
right,
you know, you hope things would have moved on, but as we still know from some of the stats that for, you know, mothers of colour, you have an increased likelihood, the chances are double of a mother of colour, a black mother, having a stillbirth than it is for a white woman in this country in recent stats.
Yeah, they just released, is it the Embrace report? Which they had delayed. I know they delayed it because of lockdown for some reason. And I know they just release it, but would you mind if people don't, because I think a lot of people don't know, so this is the most recent report still says that women of colour are 5 times more likely than their white counterparts
to
die in childbirth.
Yeah.
In this country.
I think the thing is, I think it's a really tricky conversation to navigate, I think, because the reality is for many people, we talk a lot about unconscious bias, and I think some of these things all get wrapped up. The issue is, obviously, the data's not lying. This is the data. These are the facts. we have to separate that from the fact that we think of midwives and nurses as nice and good people. Mm. Because if we go down that train of thought, what happens then is then we say, well, then we just don't know why this could be happening. It's not about people being nice and good or not nice and not good. It's about the fact that there's obviously something going on in terms of when a mother of colour comes in and presents with certain symptoms and certain other, like a slowness of labour or illness, that they're either not being checked, not being believed, or not being followed up with, or else the stats wouldn't be what they are.
Mm.
You know, all of us, you know, I'm sure are invested in no mums dying after birth and no babies dying where it is preventable. But clearly that's not happening. And we have to question why. I really feel sad if we turn our faces away and say, well, I know so-and-so and she's a midwife and she's lovely. You know, nice people can still carry biases that have behaviours attached to it that can end up impacting people. And that's the conversation that we need to have. It's not about saying that people are necessarily racist, although we know some people are, but it's not about saying that. What we're saying is when black mothers are coming in, when Asian mothers are coming in, you know, and I sometimes even myself get all the phrases wrong, but when BAME mothers are coming in,
they're the not phrases we the have at the care. Moment, which aren't really doing the job, but it's all we have. So yeah, I understand.
Yeah, but they're not being looked after in the same way that white mothers are being looked after. Because if it was to occur naturally, the stats wouldn't be that. The stats would occur naturally as the population occurs. So I think
you're so right, and it's a really difficult conversation, which means it's important, which means we need to have it. And it's really nuanced as well. And I think what you've said there is so interesting, because it's like, it's not about good or bad. You know, I think traditionally what we, like you said, are having our heads of like, well, if medical negligence happens, you know, someone is bad or they're stupid or they were unthinking. And of course, when the stats go, oh, well, these mothers of colour are dying more, therefore someone must be, you know, not caring for them consciously. But as you said, it's a really nuanced conversation, that unconscious bias does exist. We know that, like, that again, there's loads of facts to back that up. So then if someone says to you, I'm in pain, do you just not hear it in the same way as you would if a white woman was saying it, you know? And if you're a white midwife and it's a white woman, do you listen a different way? We know unconscious bias exists. We know if someone looks like us and sounds like us, you know, we act better. Like, it's such an awful thing to know about humans.
But it's a reality.
Yeah, it's a reality.
And we need to embrace the reality of the situation. Mm. And it's not about letting anyone off the hook or putting someone on a hook. It's about saying the hook is there.
Yeah.
And whether or not we like it, we're in this space where it's actually killing people.
Yeah.
It's actually causing deaths. It's actually causing babies not to be born alive. So whether it's unconscious or whatever it is, now is the time to look at the numbers and say, let's tackle this head on. You know, I think it's always really interesting because we get all these reports and, you know, I'm not anti-reports. I'm not anti any of it. But actually, in the intervening time between commissioning a report and knowing the data's bad and actually making recommendations, how many more people enter into this grief cycle needlessly because it could be prevented? And I think that there is nobody whose heart should not break over a child not having a mother and it was preventable, not taking a baby home and it was preventable. And so we can look at it as virtue signalling and hand-wringing and, you know, whatever else we want to look at these things as, and people do. But the fact is, when you get down to the end of every stat, there's a person. And that person, whether that person meant it, was careless, just not thinking, just had an unconscious bias, there's someone that's not here today because of that. And so for me, we can never think that, unfortunately, that person's feelings is greater than the loss that we'll have, that, you know, that could happen. And so for me, a lot of the time, it's actually about saying, well, yes, I'm not saying you're a bad person, but what I'm saying is, because of the way you work, you can be careless, but that carelessness can have an impact that can be so far reaching into someone's life. Surely, let's address it.
I mean, yeah, everything you've said, you know, it's, like I said, it's not easy. It's not easy to have these conversations, but I, you know, we talked a bit about this on the show of what happened last summer with the Black Lives Matter movement, and I heard so many people being like, oh, America, America, America. And I was like, this stat that, you know, the Embrace report, the 5 times more likely for a woman of colour to die in childbirth, it's like, it's here. It's in the UK. Like, it's so easy to kind of sidestep what's happening here and be like, obviously in America there's this hugely complex problems that we are also historically wrapped up in. But it's like, I think what you're saying is so true of like, step away from that statistic and just be like, that's a person, that's a mum that doesn't take her baby home, or a baby that doesn't get a mother because of this conversation that's a bit awkward. Or hard to have, or why is that happening? And again, I think because it's nuanced, because people can't point and go, oh, we found out what it was, it's all these doctors, they were all bad, now we've got rid of them, great problem. And they want an easy solution to solve this problem, but it isn't an easy solution to solve why this is happening to women of colour. It isn't easy, it's complicated and nuanced and difficult, but we need to work out, as you said, we absolutely need to work out why. But I think people are just so desperate for things to be fixed, fixable. And because, as you're saying, it's not a magic
wand.
Everyone
wants a silver bullet. Like, what's the one thing, like you say? And I think, so I'm writing a book about communication social justice, so I'm thinking about this a lot at the moment. And one of the things that I consider is, you know, liberals of all races, I think, very comfortable with racism as like a far-right rabid notion. And so when we think about it like that, of course we don't think about our family and friends, of course we don't think about that nice, you know, school teacher, policeman, midwife, nurse, whoever it is that we know, because they're nice to us. But the reality is that our humanity can make us not nice to other people, can make us ignore things that are plain because we don't understand or we don't feel a natural affinity to. It's like I always say, you know, everyone knows what good treatment is. Because like you say, we can give it to people who look and sound like us. So we know what it is to treat people well, which means that when you're not treating people well, deep down, you also know.
And also, well is interesting, isn't it? Because like you said, it could just be ignoring someone's pain or ignoring someone's fear, or just all being like, oh, they're fine. Like, that can seem like, that's not horrible. She is fine. Turns out she's not fine. But you know what I mean? It can be something as simple as that, which I know they've done lots of, there's more data on that, isn't it? Of pain being ignored in women of colour. Women of colour being like, I'm in pain, and just not being treated.
If Serena Williams nearly died after giving birth to her child, someone who is, you know, an athlete, knows her body, has had that same thing before, has private healthcare, you know, I'm sure she, you know, I'm sure it was the top of the top that, you know, that they can afford. And if Serena Williams is not listened to in that moment, then God help the rest of us who don't have that power and privilege that she has, and the very privileged position that she is in. And so I think it's just, it's really important to think about how this affects the world that we live in. And I think we think about it being, you know, like I say, like that one mum and that one baby, but that's a whole family, that's a community impacted over and over again. And I think when you look at the how that grief will impact a community over time and how that mistrust builds up, it's easy to see how it further erodes relationship.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
People that don't look and sound like you.
It's really dangerous. It's a dangerous thing to ignore the little thing, I think, as you said, because of the, it gets bigger and bigger. So is that what you feel happened, that these midwives kind of just kept telling you it's fine, what you wouldn't listen to for a whole week? You just, and so you as a 19-year-old, I think, is also hard because you're young, so you don't have that confidence of an older woman when you're like, no, I'm going to stay here till you deal with this.
Yeah, no, and also I was young, I was a teenager. Like, I think for them, I was almost ticking every single box. And the really interesting and sad thing was when Sade had died and I was at the hospital, they realised who my dad was, and they realised who the baby's grandma was on her dad's side. So her grandma on her dad's side was a Labour councillor for Birmingham, and my dad was actually the chief exec of the primary care trust that hospital sat under. So when they realised that, they were very sorry. they gave my family the staff room for the day to like sit in and did it. But by this point, it's too late.
Mm.
And I think we need to get to the stage where if someone says they're in pain, whether or not you think they're in pain or whether or not you think it's okay, you do the due diligence that you would do for anybody else. Because realizing who my dad was at that stage, well, it's too late now, isn't it? Would you have given me better treatment had you have known that earlier? Probably. And then you kind of go back in yourself, like, should I have mentioned that? Should I have said something? Should I have done something? Which puts all of the weight of the guilt of the grief on the person who's lost, of thinking about all the ways I could have manoeuvred to get more help, when the reality is I should have been helped because I was in slow labour.
You're human,
I was plus 40
you're
weeks.
A pregnant woman, that's
and,
it.
You know, clearly something's not happening or speeding up. And just because I'm young doesn't mean that my labour's going to be fine. And I think that's another thing that kind of happens. Well, young mum, like, they just pop out babies. And I think all of these stereotypes that people carry within themselves about different kinds of people and what a teenage pregnant mum is like compared to a more mature mum, a mum who's married compared to a mum who's not married compared to a mum who's in a same-sex relationship. All of these biases that live in people end up having a lived impact. And we need to think about how do we lessen the impact of people's bias-based behaviour. Like, how do we lessen that and make it so that we're not going to stop people having biases, but we can help the behaviour to change?
Oh, it's just, what a lot to deal with at 19. And to even have those questions of like, oh, if I'd said something about my dad, is it like, baby loss is so awful. So just without any, you know, whatever race you are or age you are, any of it, it's the really, we say on the show all the time, like, there's no hierarchy in grief except for baby and child loss. Like, everyone kind of agrees that that really does trump everything. So to then have to deal with all this other stuff on top of your grief. So how did you grieve for Sade? So, I mean, what part of you, you know, it must have been all sort of so wrapped up in all these other things that were going on that I wasn't listened to, and I've had to, and I've lost my baby, and that's just sad in itself without adding that I wasn't listened to.
It was really tough. I got the autopsy and it said healthy 6-pound, 8-ounce baby. And I think there's nothing that kind of rocks you. But at 19, you know, I look back now, young baby, just don't know what's going on, don't know who you are, don't know what life's about, but think you know everything. So it's kind of like the worst space for something to kind of rock you, because you're in a sense of knowing yet not knowing how much you don't know. So I think I kind of shut down a particular side of me. I moved cities and to just kind of start afresh. I went to go and study journalism. I did my degree. I became a TV weather girl, then newsreader. Like, I did my master's. It was like there was a part of me that kicked into like this high functioning capability that I'd always had within me that was probably a little bit dormant when I got pregnant. Hence, I was got pregnant, but it kind of kicked off this like high capacity side of me, which was actually useful in some ways, because I don't know what life would have been like if I had a shutdown emotionally or in that capacity. But part of me, should I say, did shut down emotionally in terms of just really just wanting to insulate myself from that kind of heartbreak ever happening to me again. And I think I can look back at my life now and just see what that did to me in an emotional sense in terms of relationship building, dating, like not even wanting to even get close to a situation that would result in me being pregnant, because I was just terrified, because it was just something so out of my control.
Yeah.
So there was just this whole side of me that was just shut down, not functioning. And that, I feel like, came over years and years and years. Like, took me years and years and years to unravel. And I can honestly probably even say that lockdown is the first time I've ever really faced it very intensely. I've been to counselling, so I've done all of that. But lockdown, in the sense of being very much with yourself and very much with your life and what it is and what it's not, I think has been the most intense time of grieving.
That's so interesting, Danelle, because I can really... So my dad died when I was 15, and we talk a lot on the show about teenage bereavement in terms of often parental and grandparent loss, and how it's just a shock. It's such a shock. You don't have the vocabulary for it, so you sort of spend your 20s like not really knowing what that was that just happened to you, and then you sort of hit your 30s and you're like, oh, I think this might be related to my dad dying. Like, I think, let me think about it, all these things I've done. And I was very much the same, like just head down. I wasn't like a hard worker, but I was so determined about so many things to push all the thoughts out. Just push all the thoughts out. I'm going to just work. But to have to deal with a child loss at 19, like I really, really feel for you, because even though my dad died young and it was early, there was still this kind of... I just felt I got to the club early. Like, everyone's dad is going to die. I've just got here early. But to lose a child so young, that is like you said, that is a complete topsy-turvy, like... I'm dealing with really huge grief and I am so young. Like, I am not in that capacity to kind of really know what's happened to me. Really know. No. Like, and I think when you're 19 as well, you do think, oh yeah, I'll get over things. That's sort of how you think. That's how I felt with my dad. Like, I guess I'll get over this. I don't know when. I'll just wait for it. And to not know, like, you don't get over something like this. It just, you learn to live with it. You learn to carry it. So I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because part of you, this ambition and drive appears and you do things and people go, wow. But it's coming from this place of like agony.
It's coming from like a deep well of like nothingness. Mm. And so from that space, you can never fill it.
Yeah.
So the work was never enough. Like, I could work and do and do and do and be and be like I, and became very used to that way of living. Working crazy hours, like being journalists, like starting early in the morning, finishing late at night, and kind of weirdly being okay with it whilst not being okay with it, because I knew I wanted more, but I just was too afraid, just like too scared to like get off that roller coaster. And I still suffer from it now, like in that same sense of, like you say, you know, you get to your 30s and you get to your mid 30s and then it's like, okay, like you're seeing like 40s on the horizon, and I looked at your date of birth, so you're just a couple of weeks older than me.
Oh, right.
So now we're kind of coming to that precipice, and then you start thinking, well, what is this all about? Like, what am I doing? Like, is this the life I'm choosing, or am I settling? Like, is it bad to settle? Should I? What should I want? What should I do? And to start to now me think about, okay, well, actually, I would like to have children. And at this, in terms of like and what they call, you know, geriatric mums, at this stage of life now re-entering, thinking in that way, has been a big part of the grieving process. Because before, I wouldn't even open that little Pandora's box, really. Like, I would talk about it. And I've always kind of talked about it, but it almost felt like a story I was telling, almost like it didn't happen to me. Mm. But lockdown, and as I feel like everything has come together in terms of who I am in that sense. It's like all merged. And so not being able to not face it has meant that I'm kind of kicking on with work still on one hand. So still like this crazy, like work, more projects, give me more. And, but on the other hand, this real, emotional feeling that was starting to well up in me of like, I'm not okay about, like, this is not okay. Like, I'm not coping. And now I feel like the grief is coming close to me, because now I'm starting to feel it and to think about it. And so working with Sans has been great and interesting, because on both hands, I love working with Sans and I love what they do, and it's still very necessary that they do it.
Mm.
And on the other hand, working so closely with it does bubble up something within me.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's so easy for me to almost say bubbles up within you. Because again, it's that dissociation that you can so often have, and it's not bubbling up in you, it's bubbling up in me.
But isn't it funny, because I totally relate to that. Like, so my story, inverted commas, was like, I'd say, yeah, my dad died at 15. Yeah, it's really sad. And it was like, I could just say it so easily. And when I've said this story on the show before, apologies, but my therapist made me say my dad's dead. And I had never said that. My dad died at 15. It's like, oof, just easy breezy. What a narrative.
Boring.
Yeah, boring. And I had to say, my dad's dead. And I was like, oh, I've never said that. And when she sort of said to me, have you ever said that? I thought, oh, maybe I'm not all right. Like, these things.
Maybe I'm not.
Oh, I thought it was fine.
It's hard, isn't it?
It's really hard. But what's interesting about you working with Sans, I think, a bit like me with this show, it's like, one part of your head is like, no, keep going. And another part of you agrees to do something which is going to make you face the grief. And so you're sort of looking
at yourself. It's like picking a scab, isn't it? It's kind of like, here's a wound and I'm just going to pick it some more.
Yeah.
But I think for people like us who are probably very good at talking about it, like very good at like that distance, I almost think working in this way is something that we feel really drawn to, because there's also something in us that says, unless you continue to face it, you will continue to make it a story.
And you
will continue to make it kind of something that's outside of you and not something that's in you.
Mm.
And I think my mom's a counsellor and psychotherapist, and my dad was a minister when I was growing up. So I was very well placed in terms of parents to help you deal. And my family, we've always talked about it. And my friends, you know, all of that. But still, somehow within that, I managed to dodge and avoid the actual emotional experience of it, and still managed to keep that kind of at an arm's length. And the minute, and I think I was scared that if I didn't do that, I would fall apart, like I would crumble. And this image that I'm building of myself, even in my own mind, of like being kick-ass and like getting on with it and just like getting on with life. And there's something almost as well about people thinking that you're doing well with coping with it, that becomes kind of like a bit of a badge.
Oh, it's
and
lovely, so people isn't it? She's doing so well.
It's like, you're so
I'm
strong.
I'm doing so well. Yeah, I do
I'm
really
doing
well,
so well.
Guys. I'm really good at
like,
this.
You know, I'm good at this grief thing.
Yeah.
I know that some people fall apart, but not me.
Not me.
And
not
I
me.
Think
I'm just very strong. I'm just very strong.
I'm just, what can I say? Yeah. Like, this is just who I, some of us are built for this struggle life.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's not a badge. And I think because I kind of just got used to this, that character and that role, and then I could just play it really well. And actually playing that really well just enabled me to just stave off the real thing. And that's why I'm personally not a fan of fake it till you make it, because I think sometimes you can be so busy faking you never make. And I think I'm always so busy faking being fine with it that I was not giving myself an actual opportunity to be fine with it.
And I think that's really interesting, because I think definitely what I did was I created a character to help me at the time when I did need to fake it. So like that first year or 2 years when you're just like, you're raw, your skin is like literally hanging off you. And I used to, like, if a train went past too fast, I'd be like, ow, like everything felt too loud and too scary. So I created this like, I don't give a shit. And then what you don't realize is like, you just get so used to putting it on every day. And it's like, it was helpful. It really did serve a purpose. It got you through that first bit when you like, you know, you wouldn't have got out of the house. You wouldn't have got dressed, you wouldn't done anything. But then you have to go, oh, it's not serving me anymore, but it's like, it's so comfy. It's like, I know. And the feeling of confidence you get of just knowing how to do something. I know how to be strong. I know how to be the person who copes really well. I know how to do that. Please don't take that from me.
Like, yeah, no.
That's really
it's
nice.
It's the one thing I've got left.
Yeah, like,
it's really the one thing
exactly.
that I'm good at. And I guess it's so hard, because I reflect on this often. Society likes it because it's easier for everybody else. Like,
so much easier, yeah.
So because you also know it's easier for everyone else, you just wear it. Like, sometimes I reflect on some of the conversations I had with friends where like my heart was just like breaking. And the best thing to do would have been to be like, I don't want to talk about this right now, or I really just can't share in your baby joy right now, or but rather than doing that, I would just swallow it, because you're just like, well, I just want to be there for someone. I just want to do the right thing and be the good friend and all of these things.
And then they learn. Then they think, oh yeah, she lost a baby, but she's okay talking about it. Like they think they've got it.
Yeah, and so they think that we all know the measure of each other, and we really don't. And sometimes I just really, like, one thing I always try to do with everyone, anyone I speak to in general, is I try to say, how are you? Mm. Because just allowing someone to answer that question can just help them over time to feel that they can answer it.
Yeah.
Because when people just say, call you and just be like, oh my God, like this thing, blah, 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 blah. Oh my gosh, anyway, gotta go. you know, sometimes you just never know what someone is carrying in the cavities of their heart, like, and how they are today. And so I always try to ask people, like, how are you? Because even just through lockdown, like, just the collective grief and the collective grief moment has just been massively overwhelming, and I just want to honour that in other people in the way that I would just love other people to honour that in me.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. It's funny, when the lockdown started, you know, obviously the beginning bits just was like, oh my God, what's happening? And then maybe about 4 weeks in, I was like, this feels like grief. I was like, what? This is weird. And I, on the Griefcast Twitter, I was like asking the other griefsters, and everyone was like, yeah, this feels like grief. What is it? And I'm not surprised, you know, obviously it's very sad, but I'm not surprised that all that grief has bubbled up in this silence, because it's when you take away, if you're someone who uses distraction to distract you from grief, lockdown has been tough, because it's like
lockdown. Oh, it's been real. It's been a struggle.
All my distraction, all my noise. The noise. I really live on noise. I love
going out
in the
for
city,
dinner,
you know?
Cocktails, even just going for a coffee after the gym.
Yeah.
Like, these are all things that we fill all of our time with. And when I reflect, because I live by myself, my family live far away, so they're all in Birmingham, I'm in London, so I can't, even when lockdown was eased, it's not like I could just go to their garden or anything like that. And so, you know, I've seen my parents once since when did I go and see them? Maybe May, June. And I haven't seen my niece and nephews. I think I saw them in August and September, actually, my birthday. But to miss, when we were allowed, but to miss seeing just people that you know. Like, I say, like, I know sometimes people are like, oh, I'm so fed up with my husband or whatever, and I can imagine that that is also very real, a real thing. But sometimes I've gone weeks without seeing a single person that I know, much less touching anyone. And I think in the absence of all of that, all the friends, all the everything, just everything that I had lost and maybe just not counted or thought about because I had all these other things to distract me, with every single one of them gone, it's not even loneliness, because I can't say that I feel lonely. I feel alone, but I don't feel lonely. But it's just the intense longing that you can sometimes not experience for someone or something, that is heightened because everything is emotionally heightened. And so I think in that space, for people, like you say, who are good at distracting, there is nothing.
There's nothing.
You are like facing it.
And it feels so griefy. I found that really, like when people have talked about the emotions I've seen my friends go through who have not been in the club, has been like watching someone grieve. Like at 6 months, they were like, I can't believe we're still doing it. And I was like, you're grieving. Like, this is grief. Or like the shock and the way they'd be like, 3 months in, they were like, it's fine, I'm fine, it's going to be fine. And I was like, you sound like you're grieving. And so much of grief is this feeling of like wanting the world to stop, wanting everyone to just stop doing what they're doing because this thing has happened. And it fucking did. And like you said, it's like...
And then we were like, no!
No, don't stop!
We were like, world, don't stop! Yeah. I feel like we didn't know how much we relied on like busyness. I feel like it was the stage where life was so busy that you were glad to turn down the invitation to see someone. You were glad to not go. You were glad to not have FOMO.
Joy, I get to stay home. It's cancelled. You know, it's just kind of like,
yeah, I just didn't go because I've just had such a full-on week. And to really think about all the times that you turned down seeing people and how you would like literally beg to go and see someone and beg to like race someone to the bar to have a cocktail. It's like, it's crazy. But like you say, you know, you go through all those stages of, I can't make this happen, I'm totally fine, I'm not okay. No, you know, I've come to terms that was last week, you know, I'm good this week. And then something else, you see something, and then again, you're like, and to think like you cry tears, like when the government announces something, it's slightly unreal, but this is where we are. Yeah. And so I think this lockdown has been like the best and worst of times. I think, like,
and how have you found that, like, how with your grief for your daughter in lockdown, like have you done anything, have you reached for any rituals or something, like how has that sort of manifested itself?
I think it's really interesting, because I think it's just manifested itself. When my daughter died, I said to myself, right, Janelle, you're 19, I'm going to give yourself a year, and after this year, anything that happens, you're not going to put it down to, like, losing Sade. Like, at 19, you can really think those things, because you genuinely believe them. But I think what it has kind of reaffirmed in me is almost that kind of desire I had then, which was to live. Like, I had a desire to live, which I couldn't do because I didn't know what I was doing. But I think now, thinking about that loss and thinking about the reality of what I lost has helped me to honour it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Rather than it's like this kind of vague memory of something that happened to me, maybe, like a story. I've actually been better able to honour it by thinking about it.
Just give it the time to think. The time to think, oh, how do I feel about that? Because you can, you know, it, like you said, once it becomes a story and a thing that just happened to you, like, just, oh, I once went skiing and I also knew this thing that this person had died. Like, it's just these things that sort of occurred.
It's just a blur.
Yeah.
And I won't think, like, yeah, I can open up my heart to have children. Like, I could open up my heart to... I have a coach and she's great and she said, you know, what are you willing to do to give yourself what you want? And actually that made me think, and to give myself what I want, I have to give this grief its proper place and then give it up. Like, not like give it up, but then like give it up.
Yes, yeah,
because
I know what you
mean.
Because
by not dealing with it, it holds a bigger space.
Yeah, because when you're trying to avoid it, it's such a lot of work. Like, actually, it's such a lot of work to avoid it, to keep yourself busy and distract for the thing. And actually, when you give it space, then you don't need to avoid it. So it can just be there and be fine and not have to be something that you're like, oh God, when is it going to be there? When am I going to start thinking about it? Oh shit, what am I going to do?
Yeah, and it's like I don't know if you've ever read The Untethered Soul, where he talks about, like, the thorn. And he says, like, you know, everyone has a thorn. And he says, you know, and then what we do is, like, rather than take the thorn out, we put a plaster on it, then that's not enough. Then we put something else on it. And before you know it, you've built this whole contraction around this thing where it's like nothing can touch this thorn.
Yeah, it's so, painful. Don't touch it, don't look at it. Like,
yeah, don't touch it, don't look at it, don't, you know, can't bump it. But actually, what you need to do is remove the thorn, yeah, because that's actually what needs to happen. And it almost felt like that for me, like I'd built all of these things, work, friends, dinners, terrible dating, just like mad living, you know, all around just not touching this thing, like not just not going near it. And actually what I needed to do was go near it, remove it.
It's so hard. It's the thing with grief is it's very easy to know what you're supposed to do. It's
not after it's
yeah, but it's not easy to do that because it's the thing of, like, I mean, it took me years and years. I mean, you know, where, like, I think it was 18 years after my dad died that I went to therapy, because I just, like, the idea, like you said earlier, that Pandora's box, the idea of even mentioning there was a box, like, I wouldn't even, it's like, don't even mention it, don't talk about it, don't think about it, because if you, it will explode. And then in therapy, one of the main things that happened to me was just being able to open the box, cry, and then carry on. Because I honestly thought, if we open it, that's it. I'm gone. Well, I'll never stop ever again.
I'll cry rivers. Cry rivers, and I won't. Because you feel like you're going to cry and you're not going to stop.
Yeah, I, like, really sometimes thought
it feels like, and my mom's a counsellor, so when she first had her practice, she used to work from a room in the house. And one day I heard this woman screaming, like crying hysterically. And I remember after my daughter died, just thinking, I just don't want that to be me. Because for most of us, the feeling of breaking down completely is just more than we can bear. And, you know, we talk a lot about the British stiff upper lip. It prevents a lot, but we like it because it's stopping us from that wall. You know, we all talk about we want to get rid of it, but actually for most of us, that has become a safety blanket from keeping us feeling like everything is just going to absolutely go to like a million pieces. And I heard that crying and just thought, I never want that to be me. And that not wanting to go there just held back from healing because I just was not willing to let it go. So,
well, I'm not surprised, because when you're so young, that's again, I think perhaps what we share from being teenagers, of like you don't know you come back from it. You don't know. You see crying, you see someone wailing, you think, oh, that's the worst thing that could ever happen to anyone. Look at that. Oh, no thanks. I don't want that. Because you don't know. That's what life is. Everybody screams and cries, and then they go, and they blow their nose and they feel better. So, but I think you sort of make these decisions as a teenager of like, oh, that's bad, don't do that. And you never do it, rather than being like,
well, it's almost like,
you know, maybe she was feeling like better after speaking to your mum. Like,
what? Probably, because she let it out. Yeah. It's like people who make vows to people who have died and say, well, I told them that I would never do this. You know, it's this kind of pent up thing that you feel like if I go over the edge of that, like that precipice, like there's no coming back from it. And it's just not true. And I think my mom said to me at the time, like, grief comes like waves. If it came all at once, you like wouldn't be able to handle it. And you know, I've definitely felt that wave-like, and I think probably held it back so long with the dam that now it's been more like a tsunami, I think, in lockdown. And I think that's also the thing. You cannot hold back the tide of it.
No.
You can pent it up, but you cannot hold back the tide of grieving. And I think the intensity of the feelings I have now and I've been having, I wonder, what would that have been like had I ever allowed it just to come and just to embrace it? And I know you can't go back and do it better. I'll lose more people. Like, that's the inevitable, you know, as we get to the other age of life. But I think I look at 19-year-old Janelle and just, I think now also with a lot more sympathy, like, you just did what you could.
Yeah, I think, and that's so
in
important.
In all aspects.
That's so important, because I think when it does happen, when you have a trauma very young, I think I definitely went through a phase of like, oh, I did it wrong. She should have done this. And now I'm so much more empathetic to that 15-year-old, because I'm like, you did the best you could. Like, under the circumstances, you did the best. And I also wonder, when you have delayed grief, of like, it comes when you're ready. You know, like, even if at 25 someone had sat you down and gone, Janelle, this is all the stuff you need to know, you need to, you might still not been able to hear it and still not be able to do it. Like, it comes when you're ready. And I think lockdown is a weird thing because it's, it sort of really goes, oh, even if you're not ready, here's the silence. Like, oh, okay. But it took me so, like, I felt exactly the same. Like, it's a wave, fight it, just run. My thing was like, just run as fast as you can. It will never catch up with you. You keep running. And now I realise it's like, oh, it feels like waves, but actually it's sort of like this weird thing that sits with you. It just, it's not a wave. It's just always there. It's like a bug you can't get rid of. It's like,
yeah,
it just,
it's just always there in your mind. And I think it's just now, rather than trying to suppress it, I just, like you say, let it just sit at the back of my mind. It's there, it's happening. I do have thoughts and feelings associated with it. There are some things that upset me because of it, and allow myself to be upset with that, allow myself to distance myself from things that massively upset me and not feel like I should have to put up with it, or I just shouldn't say anything, or I should just be, you know, make it easier on other people and not make them feel bad. And it's not that I want to make people feel bad, but I also have to recognize what, like you say, like, what can you manage? Like, it comes to you and you can manage. But sometimes we don't need all the additional things that we do take on from other people, because we just don't want to say, like, that's not good for me, or
it must have been very hard
when, like this,
when you hit that age when everyone's, you know, as we are the same age, when everyone starts having babies. And that must have been really, really difficult to face that. And I guess, especially in your 20s, maybe it was easier to avoid. Again, you can keep distracted. Everyone's like, oh, God, don't get pregnant. We're having fun. But then when people do start going, oh, I'm now going to have a baby. And it happens, doesn't it? Like, I know most of my friends my age have had a year when, like, fucking everyone got married and everyone, like, everyone from school, you're just like, what? Jesus, I'm going to another wedding. And so it must have been, hard to, when it comes knocking, when you, like you said, and I think that's really interesting what you said of, like, it's not that sometimes you just can't celebrate other people's joy. And that's not, that doesn't mean they are not allowed that joy. Like, that's the thing.
No.
It's not one or either or. Like, it's like, well, now, because Janelle's upset, no one could be happy. It's like, no.
No. I think we need to remember, like, we can hold those two things. Like, I'm happy for you, but I'm sad for me.
Yeah.
And the sadness for me, and also the space I need to hold to keep myself full as a person, and just as someone who needs to, like, function, go to work, do everything. The space I need to hold for myself means that I cannot be close to that. Not because I'm not happy for you. Like, I'm happy because you're happy, and because this is something that you want, and I want you to have the things that you want in your life. 100%. But the space where I'm sitting with this grief, with myself in this moment, I can't sit with you.
I think that's really a really good way of putting it. That's a really good way of putting it. Like, I just can't sit with you right now. And I think sometimes what friends don't understand, it's like, it's not forever. I'm not saying it's forever. I might just need some time.
Some space.
And then I can, you know, hear about your great day with your dad or see your baby pictures. I can, but I might just need little 5 minutes even just to be like, oh, fuck, like, ow.
Yeah, and just, like, it's Mother's Day, you know, it's Father's Day.
Yeah.
It's these moments that people really sit in the intense emotion because of the fact that the whole world is stopping to talk about this particular thing. And, you know, I always just try to be really mindful, and I think maybe losing Shade kind of did this, tries to be really mindful that the world is, as we said earlier, nuanced and complex. And it's not about saying you can't enjoy Mother's Day. It's not about saying you can't enjoy Father's Day. It's not about saying anything else. It's just about saying, as we share our exuberance, be mindful of those around you who, that is like a thousand knives. And so I have both my parents now, but one day I won't. And I just want to make sure I extend to other people that same thing that I feel, and not just be like, it's all great. And I think it's interesting how fast human beings can move from, wanting something and not enjoying when other people doing it to having it and then forgetting what that feels like to not have.
Yeah.
And it's a constant state of spank. And I think this is part of being human. This is kind of what separates us. It's about thinking about others and it's about holding space for others whilst holding space for ourselves. When I'm pregnant next time, I don't know how I'm going to feel. I might be really overjoyed and want to talk about it, or knowing me, I'll probably like go into complete hermit mode. Like, I'm not going to talk about this. I don't want to speak about it. But whatever I do, I would hope to, for my friends to hold space for me and for me to hold space for others who are in the space that I've just left.
And I think that's also, it's why it's important to get so many different stories. Because I know Mother's Day and Father's Day, like I obviously came from a parental loss point of view, so I really understood, like, if I knew people who were like had lost their mums and they were like, oh, Mother's Day, and it genuinely, well, the first time said to me, oh yeah, and for us who've lost children, I was like, had not occurred to me, because I was so set from my parental loss point of view. That was the only way I could envision a Mother and Father's Day was about your parent. And I think it was someone on Twitter, actually, on the Griefcast, was just like, oh yeah, you know, for us who've lost children, Mother's Day is fucking awful, because I'm not anymore, or am I? I am still, but I'm reminded that they're not. And again, I was like, oh, of course, of course. Which is why it's so important, you know, to do the amazing work that you're doing, even though it's so hard, like, and for charities like Sands, and for people to have those uncomfortable conversations, because every time someone does, hopefully one, even if it's one person, it's like, oh, hadn't occurred to me. Okay, noted. I won't
do that again.
Yeah. And it's not about making someone feel bad or you did wrong. It's just about learning.
I think the interesting thing has been always with me when friends have had their first pregnancy. Because when you have your first pregnancy, of course, you want to talk about it, like I did when I was first young. And actually, it's just not a space I can hold.
Mm.
I've come over the years to realize it's not a space I can hold. It is just not. I just can't. And people might say, well, maybe she's trying to get over it and different things, but it's just not a space I can hold. I remember the first time I went to a maternity hospital after, it was to go and see my sister's baby.
Mm.
And I remember just walking in, going into the room, looking at my niece, my first niece, and just walking out the room and sitting in the corridor and just crying my eyes out, because I just couldn't. And, you know, Mother's Day and all of those days. And I think, like you say, like, if we can just help one other person to see the point of view, and they tell one other person to see a point of view.
Yeah.
Like, then hopefully the world will become a compassionate place. I think we hear things like be kind, and we think about certain kinds of kindness, like just like not being mean, essentially, on social media. Yeah. But actually, be kind contains so much if you'll let it.
Mm.
Like, people say, oh, I'm an empath, and oh, I'm be kind. It's not about soaking up someone else's feeling in that sense. Be kind is about anticipating sometimes where need is, and anticipating sometimes where sadness is, if we can and if we want to. And it's about having the self-awareness and wanting to do that. And I think if we took that approach in general, be kind would mean something.
Yeah,
it would mean so much more. Like, and that's why I'm grateful for Sam's, and, like, you know, their befriending and all the different ways that they support, not just parents, but they support the whole wider community, because it's about anticipating the way that loss, like I said earlier, impacts and ripples communities and so many people. How can we be kind?
And that must have been that must have been so hard for you, so hard to walk into your sister, and of course you're happy, and that's all, there's all this joy and there's all this sadness. And it comes back to what we said as well, of like, you're not taking away people's joy, which I think is how it's often interpreted, of like, oh, well, a grieving person comes along and it's suddenly they're crying.
And the energy gets sucked out of the room.
Suddenly we're all depressed. And it's like, there has to be room for all those feelings, because of course there's joy for a new baby being born. And of course there's sadness for what happened to Shardé. Both those things exist. And I think it almost comes back around to what we're saying about, like, what you just said, really, the kindness, and what we were saying earlier about unconscious bias and stuff. Like, everybody wants it to be really neat and tidy. Like, you know, you have a grief, and you deal with it and it's done. And now you can be happy for people who have babies, please, because otherwise it's really awkward and we don't know what to do with you. And it's like, no, it's not. Like, if it's much more nuanced than that. It's a bit subtle. Sometimes you might be okay. Sometimes it's a tough day. Sometimes it's not. Like, we just have to check in with each other.
And I think that's the thing. It's the checking in. It is the checking in. Like, that is what is the kindness in reality, is just the kind of, look, I've got this thing. Would it be okay? Like, do you want to hear about this today?
Yeah.
Or not?
I've definitely learned that with, especially, you know, I think when you're... when you're in your 20s and babies, it's just this thing of like, oh my God, she's pregnant. Like, oh my God, like, oh, is she going to keep it? That's often the conversation women are having. And as I've learned as I get older, like, the conversation is just like, you do not know what people are going through, like, whether it's infertility issues or IVF, or they've had an abortion and now there's infertility issues. Like, there's so much stuff. Like, when women start in women in their 30s and talking about babies, that I now, like, I do not ask people these questions.
I don't ask people. I don't even go there. No, like, you know, once I remember going to the doctors at the same hospital for another appointment afterwards, a gynae one, and they said, you know, if you had got any children, and I said no. And he said, any pregnancies? And I said no. And he said, abortion. I was like, no, it was a stillbirth in this hospital, actually, down to the negligence of your midwives. It doesn't... insensitivity is so close to us all the time.
Yeah.
Me included. Like, I'm saying also, me included. Insensitivity is so close to us all the time. I think, like you say, it comes down to the duality of who we are as humans. Mm. We're nice and we're awful.
Yeah.
We're kind
same time.
And we're mean.
And you can really like not mean it. You can really...
We're all these things, and impact and intent are not the same thing.
Yeah.
So God. Just because you didn't intend to make someone upset... I remember a friend after I lost Sade was like, oh, I'm going to this thing, are you going? And someone said, oh, you know, I just feel really bad whenever you go somewhere because you've lost the baby. She was still pregnant at the same time. And I get what she's saying, but...
There's ways of saying it.
There's ways of saying it, babe. And you probably shouldn't have said it to me. But like you say, you know, but this is the thing, because for that person who's still carrying a baby, you know, your biggest fear is losing a child.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to be surrounded by stories of child loss. But we just, I think it's because we're so uncomfortable with the full spectrum of life and the full spectrum of emotion. And like you say, like, how we hold the two things at the same time. Happy for you, sad for me.
Yeah.
You know, very nice person, has a bit of dodgy behaviour connected to my biases and just sometimes myself sometimes. Like,
yeah.
And the more we can hold both things in our own heads about ourselves and about others, is then the easier it becomes to ask more than we say.
And also, I think it's the other thing I've learned, and again, I'm not perfect, I've said really stupid things over the years, but I think to check in with someone, you know, if you have noticed a comment, or if there has been a baby shower invite and you know somebody has had a difficult situation, has lost a baby, is trying for a baby, to just send a message and be like, oh, hey, like, how are you feeling about that? Like, it's just, I've had it even when people have, like, you know, it's Father's Day or something else is, you know, parental has happened, and just a friend be like, oh, were you all right? Was that a bit tricky? And even if I'm like, oh, no, actually it wasn't today, that was fine. Just the feeling of like, oh, thanks for being aware that for me, that was a weird moment. But for everyone else, it was joyful. But for me, it was like, ugh. And that's what you need, isn't it? Just someone to sort of stand in your shoes just briefly to be like, oh, God, that might be a bit tricky for Janelle.
Briefly.
You know.
And even if online, you're fine. Even if you're going about your daily business.
Yeah.
Even if everything to the outside world looks normal. I think the one thing that most people want is just that friend, that family member, to just remember.
Yeah.
Just like you say, remember, this is a bit tricky.
Yeah.
Was that okay? And then you can say no. And I think the other thing with that is to wait for the answer.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we're like, how are you? And then we spiel off into whatever it is, you know. Sometimes actually, if you know it's a bit tricky, just wait for the answer.
Yeah.
Like, and let them have the answer. Then if they're fine, proceed. If they're not fine, then you can't proceed. But I think if lockdown hopefully has taught us anything, is like how connected we actually long to be. And then to think about what gets in the way of those connections, actually.
Oh, Janelle, I mean, that's such a, I'm gonna, such a beautiful thing. I was like, I'm not gonna add anything to that amazing, wise comment. Thank you so much for talking to me. And if people have been through a similar situation or what you went through, then SANS are an amazing charity, and, you know, just head to their website and have a look at the resources. I said, I know they offer that befriending service where they, it's someone who's
befriending, yeah, and all kinds. And even if it's like a friend of yours that's lost a baby and you don't really quite know how to talk to them, you don't know how to sit in that space with them, then SANS also offer resources for people who have not gone through it but are supporting someone else through it as well.
Yeah,
as well as having counsellors on the end of a phone.
Amazing, because so many people, like you said, like we're talking about, want to do the right thing, don't quite know. And I said, there are so many charities who are like, let us help you. We've dealt with these people. We can tell you. So yeah, don't be afraid to look for help. Thank you so much. Your wisdom is, it was so nice to talk to you, and so nice to hear about Sade as well, and, you know, remember her for this moment. So thank you.
Thank you, Cariad.
You can follow Janelle on Twitter at Janelle Aldred. That's GENELLE. Aldred is ALDRED. And if you want any more information on SANS, head to their website. That's SANS, SANDS.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you are not alone.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.